Hi everyone! Thanks for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Thea. For this episode, we are joined by James Woodcock to talk about his book, Ego Flip: How to Reset Your Leadership Life. James Woodcock is a partner in Korn Ferry's Leadership and Professional Development Practice. Prior to that, he was a managing consultant at PA Consulting and a senior manager at Deloitte. For the past 20 years, James has worked across the globe helping leaders fulfill their potential. Ego Flip explores the paradox of self-reference that lies at the heart of leadership. That is the story of ego. The book examines the assumptions that have shaped the conventional view of leadership and offers a radical new paradigm and way to lead. Hi, James. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on a Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your first book, Ego Flip. And my first question to you is, why did you decide to write it?
Thanks, Tara. So listen, let's just take a moment and look at the world. And, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, the world today is very much like it was yesterday. But at the same time, when we look at it, we could say that, you know, the story of our world, there really appears to be kind of an acceleration taking place. And I think many of us sort of feel we're facing into a world that is increasingly out of control. This year is like, you know, no other, with half the world going to the polls to elect new set of leaders. But the saying goes, as you know, that change has never been this fast, but it's never going to be this slow again. So we're kind of on a one-way ticket with this ride. Every organization is struggling to navigate these headwinds of geopolitical instability, economic turbulence, climate change. It's kind of a perfect storm. And the easy mistake is to think that this increasing global inequity comes out of something bigger than ourselves. These problems are so complex, so intractable, but you know, the origin of this dysfunction, but also its solution, and the one that's going to require every organization to radically adapt in our lifetime, is leadership. So leadership really is the cause. So the question is, can leadership get us out of this mess? And the good news is undoubtedly, yes, it can, but only if we radically rethink what it means to lead. And that's why I wrote Leadership. I think leadership needs a reset. If it's a sort of analogous in some ways to a computer system, if leadership is a computer system, we could say that it's running on an old program, an outdated program. And the name that I give to that program is ego. We need to talk about ego. And so I wrote Ego Flip really to kind of address a deeper conversation about leadership and really to invite people to be curious, you know, a bit like Alice in Wonderland. Let's find out how deep that rabbit hole goes.
Absolutely. But could you tell us what the role ego plays when it comes to leadership?
Yeah, it's a great question because there's different definitions of what ego is. So the classical definition, so Freud's definition of ego was about this executive function that controls your instinctive demands for gratification, call it the id. And the goal, therefore, of sort of psychological therapy was to strengthen the ego. And so I'm definitely not talking about that. Ego is really about the core of our sense of self, our individuality. And one of the common misconceptions is that ego is this personality trait that imbues confidence and resilience, and so it's necessary to function as a leader to be effective. But actually what ego is it's a way of thinking. It's a system of beliefs for which we identify with the world around us. And I describe these eight core beliefs, these eight tenets of ego that afford our sense of free will and authorship. And it's the beliefs that come from the conviction that when we act and when we talk and when we work and when we sleep and when we choose, all of this happens to a me, to an individual self. And these eight tenets, these eight beliefs, include our perception of causality, so cause and effect. They include transience, so our perception of time, of past and future. They include our perception of finitude, so our sense of endings, such as life and death. There's also our perception of individuality, so the sense that we're unique, that there's no one quite like me. There's also our perception of what we could call relatedness, so how we relate to our experience, the belief that we can change and be changed by our experience. There's also our perception of choice. It's a really important one. This is the one that gives rise to our belief in responsibility and also our sense of authority. And then finally, there's our perception of what we could call sort of separation, that I'm separate from my world, that I stand before an experience as separate from that. And from these beliefs come this conviction that when we act, when we think, etc., that this is something that happens to me, and they're so immutably ingrained in the worldview perspective that we really, really consider the implications for us, you know, as individuals or for the world at large. And we need to. They warrant our curiosity, because if you really look under the skin of what ego is, you can see that this belief in separation is the cause of all dysfunction in human relationships. And because of that, it's also the single biggest determinant of leadership performance. And so we can also go even further. We can say it's also the cause of all suffering in the world today, not pain, but suffering. Now, how is that the case? Well, it's this sense of separation of ego that arises in resistance when we seek to gain control of events in the world around us, in the belief that those events, those experiences can make us happy. So it's basically the idea that who we are is someone we need to become rather than the one thing we can only ever be. And for ego as our perceived locus of identity, it asserts control in this way at any cost, because it's this perception of control that in effect provides the evidence for its own existence. It's sort of this paradoxical search that it's locked into. And it's through this search, this sort of sense of separation, this feeling of lack and longing that arises is suffering. And you see, and the one thing that ego can't see is that essentially what we're talking about here is control, and control is really an illusion. Autonomy is kind of an illusion. So if we take, for example, as we are right now, we're having a conversation and, you know, I'm standing on the ground, and we could say, well, most of us with functioning limbs have the autonomy to stand on our own 2 feet, and that seems perfectly normal. But if you try that now, and you might notice that we owe at least in part the autonomy to the ground under our feet. And so we could ask ourselves, okay, so what holds up the ground? Well, the world holds up the ground. What holds up the world? And we can extend this thinking. So really, how ego shows up, it depends on whether we believe it, that we're in control of events or not. You know, be they thoughts or giving feedback or whatever. And for example, either it could lead to compulsive action, so something I refer to as fast ego, or compulsive inaction, and something I call passive ego. And they reflect different perspectives of time and change. So for individuals with fast ego, the world's really not moving fast enough, and they're always trying to reach, as it were, beyond this moment to achieve the next thing, the next sort of validation. And in contrast, individuals with passive ego, the world feels out of control and they feel compelled to step back from it. So ego shows up in really different ways. We've got to be a little bit careful that we don't make it the villain, because it's easy to villainize it in a sense. And herein lies again a paradox of leadership, or another paradox, because on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with ego. You know, ego just is, in the same way as, you know, this conversation or the room you're in, it just is. You know, it couldn't be any other way, unless, of course, in ego you seek to sort of justify it and judge it. But at the same time, it's true to say that when we act and we lead through ego, we act in resistance. And so we stop listening, we lose empathy, we stop trusting, you know, we pretend to be something we're not. Because knowingly or not, it becomes all about me. So you can't become an authentic leader, and you certainly can't understand yourself at a deeper level without addressing ego.
Absolutely, and that's all really fascinating. But now, James, I would like to explore the different parts of the book a little bit, starting the first one, where you discuss the importance of really knowing yourself. So could you tell us why it is so vital for any leader to know themselves before they can lead well?
Yeah, and so it's interesting. So I originally trained as a biologist, and I've always loved the natural world. And I'm old enough to remember a time when David Attenborough didn't have to talk about climate change. And it's ego that's driven inequity within the global system. And I do believe our failure to recognize that simple fact, not what's going on in the world, but the role that ego plays, presents perhaps our greatest existential threat, because it means we're not addressing the real problem. And that's why we need to talk about ego and how it holds back our understanding and therefore our potential, because it limits our understanding of who we are. And some of the ways I talk about this is, if you imagine the world as a painting, And so we know, you know, to understand the painting, you've got to study the painter as well. One always reflects the other. So, you know, you are the painter of this world. Is it possible to know anything for certain without first knowing the nature as of one who knows it? Or as I might put it another way, a leader can never understand the world and their place within it until they understand where they're looking from. And that's the difference between leading and being led, particularly in a world that's so often calling for our attention. You know, if you think about it, as a leader, how can you know what's important and what matters? And therefore, what you need to do as a leader if you don't know what you want? But how can you know what you want truly if you don't understand why you want it? And how can you understand why you want it if you don't really understand who you are? So every question that matters in leadership comes back to the question of the one who's asking, if you look deep enough. So leaders are typically obsessed with getting answers. Really, to me, it's about getting more interested in the questions that we're asking.
Yeah, but how can we understand ourselves better? What are some strategies to really know yourself?
Yeah, and this is a big part of what the book is really trying to answer. And if you want to get a different answer, sometimes you've got to ask a different question. So Ego Flip is a book obsessed with questions, I would say. But the questions that kind of get to the core of who you are as a leader. The traditional approach is really to explore the content of your, I call it your story. So this happened to me, so I feel like this. This is learning about your character as a leader. That's part of it, part of your story. But it's really only scratching the surface. So we need to try and, in effect, step outside of the story to really understand, you know, ourselves better. But part of the challenge with understanding the world and leadership and understanding who you are is that the tool that we use for this inquiry actually is your mind. You know, the function of the mind, but the mind has a blind spot, and it's this. It's that it equates our understanding of reality with our reality. So what I mean is that when we seek to understand the world, we use concepts, we have thinking, we have thoughts. So our mind is a bit like one of those labeling guns, you know, sticking labels in the form of thoughts onto everything it experiences. And that's the function of mind. And that is why when we see a chair, we can know what it is, because we've labeled it. You know, we've got stickers like seat or four legs or comfortable, whatever it is that the mind uses to understand it. But what the mind doesn't understand is that the label is not the same as the thing that it's attached to, the reality that it's attached to. So what this means is that to understand the reality of what it means to lead at a deeper level, it might follow that the questions we need to ask are ones that the mind perhaps might easily overlook, you know, may find easier to dismiss. So I'll give you just one example. So let's use a simple question, and the question is this. If I had to ask you the question, where are you? You're a leader, where are you? You're showing up. What does that mean? So, of course, the mind might, you know, shoot up its metaphorical arm and say, well, I know this one. It's easy. I'm at home. I'm listening to this amazing podcast. There we are. Answered. But, of course, we can go deeper than that. So let me ask it another way. I could ask, okay, so where do you end and where does your experience begin? So if you were to close your eyes and you know that somehow you exist, the question is, where is that? Where do you end and where does your experience begin? What's the boundary we perceive? Where are you? So perhaps we could look at, that's where our awareness seems to come from. Where are we aware? So we could take the act of listening, for example. So as I'm talking, you could ask yourself, where do I hear that? So does hearing occur at the, you know, the electrical signal in your ear and the cochlea? Or is it really where the signal reaches the temporal lobe? It's the part of the brain responsible for interpreting information, the sounds from the ears? Or is it where we become aware that we're listening? And if so, where does that awareness or consciousness arrive? I love philosopher Thomas Nagel's definition of consciousness. He's described it as a feeling of what it's like to be something. But then can you point to where that feeling is? You know, where are you? Where is that? Most of us identify with our body to some degree. If you lost a hand, you know, would you still be you? Most people would say, well, yeah, absolutely. But is there a part of your body that's more you than others, we could ask? You know, and pushed, many of us would sort of point to the brain. You know, consciousness might sit behind the eyes, we call the windows to the soul. So when the brain dies, do you cease to be? Or maybe you're transmuted to another time and place? What's interesting is that the average cell in your body is about 7 years old, so much of you is quite new. We do know that some cells in the body get replaced. So some of them actually remain for your whole lifetime, like neurons in the cerebellum. They stay with you. That's the part of the brain that controls balance and coordination. And also some of the cells that make up the lenses in your eyes and also scar tissue, so the cross-linked collagen. So are you residing within those cells? Another way to think about it is movement. And it's interesting because, I mean, right now, for example, we are moving about 67,000 miles per hour relative to the sun in orbit. Of course, we don't have a sense of that, but maybe if we could think about movement as a way to answer the question, where are we? So if I were to take a little step to the left, I could say, well, whereabouts am I? Well, clearly I'm here. Let me move somewhere else. Let me take a little step to the right. And of course, in our direct experience, the only ever place that we ever find ourselves is here. You go and walk across the room and I ask the question, where are you? We're only ever here. So the point of these questions is to notice that we have blind spots, and these blind spots arise every time we make assumptions about the world that limit our curiosity and how we see the world and how we see ourselves within it. So it's about really paying attention to the questions that we're asking. And in an ego flip, we have a set of seven leadership questions that really, again, dig into some of the formative assumptions that shape our thinking around leadership and ask us to question that.
Yeah, definitely. And I would encourage our listeners to, of course, get the book and try to answer those questions for themselves. But now I will move to the second part of the book where you talk about ego dynamics and the connection between the ego, our feelings, and our surroundings. So
Yeah.
could you tell us more about that connection?
In ego flip, I asked the question, what's the most important measure of leadership performance and organizational performance that you can make? And how would you do that? And it turns out it's not something that anyone's measuring, and that's ego dynamics. And to describe how ego dynamics works, the place really to start is by talking about feelings, paradoxically. So the first thing to say about feelings is that everything you experience, you feel. So thoughts, floor under your feet, movement, all these things, if you didn't feel it, you wouldn't be aware of it. And so in that sense, our feelings are as many and diverse as our experiences are, but what we don't have are words for them. So the floor is the feeling in for the floor as much as, the dark is a feeling in the dark. All thoughts are feelings. We just don't talk about it that way. Ego arises when we identify with what we feel. So when we seek to control and change our emotions, when our feelings become something that belong to us, so we seek to possess them, we believe that they define us. And these are egoic emotions, and they're quite different. In Ego Flip, I write about how the ego has a finite array of these emotions, and they're finite because they reflect how ego transacts and relates to its environment. So they reflect its search, how it tries to satisfy itself, how it seeks to control the world, how it essentially seeks to manifest who it thinks it is in the world. And part of the problem is that we're really not very precise at defining what our feelings mean. And that's because our models that we use don't interpret the role that ego plays in forming that perspective. So ego dynamics is the first universal framework for precisely describing how we self-identify through our egoic thoughts and feelings as a way to better understand the way we think, feel, and act, and the role that ego plays in our lives as leaders. And it describes the relationship between what I just called 36 egoic states. So each of these states describes both the governing thoughts, so the belief that ego has that we have in that moment, and the corresponding egoic feeling. So each state describes who you are in that moment through how you feel and why. And the model, so the ego dynamics framework, really is built around three different aspects. So the first is locus of control. So when you look at how ego shows up, depends on whether we believe we can control these events or not. The second is the perceived subject-object relationship. So between the subject of self, that's me in an experience, and the perceived objective function that I relate to within my experience. So that could be with another person, doesn't have to be. And then the third aspect is a perceived relative degree of what I could call resistance or separation from my objective reality. In other words, how much do I need that experience to fulfill myself? And so modeling these sort of relative degrees of separation reveals a natural sequence that describes effectively the minimum change in attention required to transition between these different egoic states. And it's from this that I derived a new measure for leadership performance that I call the attachment quotient, or AQ. And the ego, you know, my contention is that ego is the most important and least understood determinant of your effectiveness as a leader, because it's how you use or seek to use your personal power. So whereas, for example, emotional intelligence, or EQ, talks about how we manage our emotions through regard for self and other, what AQ does is look at what's ultimately driving that, so the degree of egocentricity or resistance between self and other, between myself and the world.
Mm. But in that part of the book, you also say that there is a radical method to change our egoic persona, and that's called Ego Flip, which is, yeah, of course, the title of the book as well. So could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, let's talk about ego flip. So the way I talk about this is, you know, with the right powers of persuasion, I could convince you of almost anything. So I could convince you that the world is flat, that you have superpowers, that your partner hates you or you hate your partner. And the only way, of course, I could do this is to convince you that it was your idea in the first place. And so, therefore, the only thing that neither I nor you could convince yourself of is that you're not you. Or to put it another way, that you don't exist. And so at the same time, much of our time is lost to ego. We spent thinking about, well, how can I be somebody else? That's almost a preoccupation that ego has. So the question is, what would it take to become someone else? And so the answer, which is quite simple, is we'd have to believe it. Within ego, when we're lost to thinking, we're lost in a story of ego. And so the ego is continuously directing our attention through thought to the past, through memory, and to the future, to conjure this kind of story of me. And we're sort of bound into ego because we believe this story so implicitly, because it's a story of who we are. And so we become lost in the drama of our life's events. It pulls us in. I think our affinity for and fascination with stories is because it reflects how easily lost we become in our own dramas. And of course, through our own life story, we play many parts. You know, we assume different ego persona, we could say, depending on different situations. We act and feel differently depending on that situation, based on what we might need from that situation or that relationship. And much of leadership development is basically asking the question, well, how do you shift that perspective? And that's shifting not just what you see, but how you think and feel about it. So ego flip is a practice for shifting perspective in a profound sense. It's about consciously shifting your persona to a different egoic state relating to the ego dynamics model. And the practice of ego flip, it's a practice, uses our current story, our current egoic persona, to effectively step into a different story. And it follows six simple steps. And I refer to ego flip as a practice as sort of the art of forgetting yourself. In a sense, that's what we're trying to do with the process. The first part of that practice, the goal is to what I call find the ego. So I'll take you through the first couple of steps to follow that part of the practice. And the first step is to stop. So we have to stop and see that we're in a story. That's our starting point. We have to stop and see that we're in a story. Metaphorically, it's a bit like when you step back from the screen and you can see that movie, that story being played out. So it's through this understanding that the story of you as a separate self is not all of who you are, that you create the possibility of seeing beyond it. I love Antonio Machado's quote. He says, "Traveler, there is no path. The path is made by walking." So in that sense, we need to recognize that our path, our story, is made by us, so that we can step away from it. So that's the first step. The second step, called spotlight. So you have to put your persona, so the part you're playing, in the spotlight, which means you need to see exactly who you are, not some approximation, but the precise nature of your ego, in order to flip to a different persona. And that's what the ego dynamic framework uniquely provides. So it's a classification of these 36 different ego states. And so we can use ego dynamics to ask the question, well, what do we think we need? And who do we feel we are in that situation? Then the third step, so once we've stopped, once we've spotlighted, we need to surrender. And the cornerstone of the ego perspective is what I call the grit beneath the pearl around which the story, ego story of me, forms, is at its most irreducible level, a single governing thought. It's how we think. So it might seem logical that to change our sense of self, who we think we are, we just simply need to change how we think. But unfortunately, the ego is the author of the thoughts persist through thinking. So to flip the ego, we've got to do the one thing that the ego is trying to avoid, which is to turn towards and embrace the feeling that it's rejecting an experience. So ego defines itself in opposition to that feeling. It's why you're never upset for the reason you think. And the egoic state, for example, of dependence arises in resistance to the feeling of coercion. There's a duality there. The egoic state of envy, for example, it endures in resistance to the feeling of vanity. The egoic state of guilt persists in resistance to the feeling of criticism. And so acceptance is the only way by which we can let go of our egoic identity. So if we take that example just there of criticism, if you imagine, take the example, you just got some really critical feedback and you're about to give an important presentation. And imagine that you take that feedback really personally. You really want to impress this group of people that you're presenting to, but now you feel your speech is going to be awful. And so the persona that you represent in that situation would perhaps be the state of guilt, and the belief that you can't get what you want from me. That's the governing thought in ego dynamics, you in this case being the audience that you're trying to impress. So in this situation, the question is, how can you drop your resistance to what we're thinking, feeling that in that moment to change your perspective? Well, you could, for example, you could reconcile that you don't need the audience's approval. But it's easy to fall into this trap of trying to reframe what you think you need in order to gain acceptance of your situation. And a common way that we do that is we try and understand something better, such as what might have caused you to feel in that way. Reframing is simply another form of resistance that perpetuates the current perspective. What we often miss is this dualistic nature of your perspective, which is what egodynamics reveals through these dual relationships of egoic states. So your perspective arises not only from your belief as a subject, but through the perception of the objective perspective, which is, in this example, the perspective of the audience, which is I can't, or your sense that I can't get what I want from you. But in resistance, our ego blind spot limits our understanding to the subjective perspective. That's what happens. So the point is that acceptance only arises through the recognition and acceptance of both perspectives, of subjects and objects. So in this example, that it's okay that you can't give them what you want, and that it's okay that they can't get what they want from you. You have to accept and recognize both sides. And when we turn towards and embrace the feeling that you've been rejecting an experience, this separation between subject and object collapses. Now, acceptance comes in this way when you change your focus, when you give attention to both of these sort of antithetical perspectives, and you only do so openly, unreservedly, without seeking to change them. But it's important to say that this sort of open acceptance doesn't require kind of a special skill or focus. It's better to say that it requires a relaxation in our attention, same as you might relax a muscle. Really, we need to be, it's about openness. We need to be open. I think openness is the most underrated quality of leadership. And so for this, it's all about creating the space that you need, whatever that looks like for you. So whether it's the space to think or the space to breathe or just a space to be, it's about creating the space and, you know, with grace and humility to be prepared to give up something of yourself, become more than you might imagine yourself to be. And that's the first loop of this ego flip practice. So the shift in perspective that arises through acceptance creates this profound shift in who we think we are in that moment. And we've all had experiences, you know, through situations perhaps beyond our design when we felt liberated, you know, like a new person emboldened. And we've thought, well, how, I love this feeling. How do I stay like this? How do I feel like this all the time? So the second part of the practice, second part of the flip loop, is about how to flip the story. How do we substantiate our new persona? And I look at three different aspects. So first of all, I look at embodiment. That is how we locate who we are through how we feel, move, and express within the body. Then secondly, how we use memory. So through the attachment or reattachment to objects in our experience. So how do we gain possession of these as we might gain possession of our persona? And then thirdly, it's about how we can indelibly change our experience to update our model of the world again, was to create evidence of our new and own existence.
Yeah, that's all fascinating, James. But in that second part of the book, there is also another chapter that really caught my attention. It's called Evil Genius Organization. So what's that organization?
Yeah, the Evil Genius Organization, and you know, much to my frustration of my son, it's got nothing to do with minions whatsoever. It's all about control, but on a bigger scale. So, you know, we've talked about how the need to control our external environment and to assert our self-image creates dysfunction and inequity within relationships on a one-to-one basis, but it also does it collectively. So on an organizational level, we clearly see the emergence of what we could call a meta-ego. When we see and describe the collective sort of institutionalized expressions of ego that are polarizing our planet, whether through economics or politics. And this is the Evil Genius Organization, or EGO. It occurs when we identify who we are with the system itself. And it's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for the operation of what I call egoic power dynamics that underpin organizational dysfunction, as it is for the systemization of ego in our societies. And when we look at this Evil Genius Organization, what we see is a really complex interplay of these egoic power dynamics that manifests specific axes of organizational control that tend the organization and its operations either towards order or chaos. It creates this tension. And there are eight of these, what I call organizing dilemmas. And they reflect not only the primary basis by which value is created across any formal system, but perhaps unsurprisingly, they directly correlate with these eight tenets of ego that I talked about earlier, these underpinning beliefs through which ego is sustained. And they're also the reason why organizations need leadership in the first place to try and reconcile these irreconcilable dilemmas. So, for example, we see that ego dysfunction arises through the duality of compliance power, so power to enforce rules and standards, operating in duality with disruptive power, so power to change the system. And this dilemma originates through the egoic tenet or belief in causality of cause and effect. We can also see another example of tensions arising between what we call predictive power, the power to provide certainty, to provide an answer, versus visionary power, so power to imagine a possible future. And this dilemma arises through our conception of transience, of past and predictability and future and unpredictability. So perhaps part of the question we can ask is, well, but how does this come about in the first place? Where does the Evil Genius Organization come from? And it comes down to give or take, or what we could call reciprocity. So reciprocity describes the relationship between two individuals that fulfill each other's needs. And so this occurs when both have differing non-competing needs to fulfill, which the other party can provide. But when relationships are not reciprocal, then they break down, they're unsustainable. But within an organization, it's a little bit different. So while you get direct reciprocity between two individuals, that still occurs, indirect reciprocity means that I can get what I need from you without needing to reciprocate, as long as you can get what you need from someone else in the organization. In other words, indirect reciprocity ensures that relationships can be sustained that would not be sustainable on a directly reciprocal basis. So, to give an example, if you imagine, say, you've got a boss and they make huge demands on a team member, but the boss doesn't offer anything in return. So, perhaps we've known someone like that at some point in time. The team member puts up with this because they've got a job to do and they get paid, and maybe they work with some brilliant team members. You take those elements out, and the team members' needs are not met, and they'll probably leave. And what this does is it creates these power dynamics, this ego power dynamics, and it's these dynamics that create a climate within the team that ultimately set the culture within the organization. And it's in this way that relationships can form that would, outside of any formal organizational context, they'd be unsustainable. But when you look in a corporate setting, they're deemed commonplace and acceptable because they can survive. And you know, it's not uncommon for individuals to be attracted to organizations and positions of power because of the opportunity to fulfill their egoic need only on off through the control that they can assert through the relationships within an organization that would not be afforded to them outside of that organization. So there's a bit about what's the hard truth here. And the hard truth is this, that organizations as they exist today in the form of formal hierarchical systems exist because of ego. They exist because of that and not what's written in the mission statement. It's ultimately the fundamental reason why organizations exist, on the basis that no organization can satisfy or seeks to satisfy its employees through intrinsic needs alone. It's simply not the case today. And so it follows perhaps that one of the most important things that any organization can do is to understand the impact of ego on their organization. And so what we can do, for example, is we can undertake an organizational assessment, a holistic assessment of egocentricity, by measuring the attachment quotient, the AQ, for each individual. And we can apply that across those eight different organizing dilemmas through which egoic power dynamics operate. So we can get a full view in terms of the impact of ego on that organization. Really, it's creating sort of a measure of what I would call relational equity within a formal system. I call it inclusion variance. And it's a new indicator, a new measure that I present in Ego Flip for measuring organizational performance.
Yeah, there is a lot of food for thought here. And thanks for sharing your insights. But now I'll move to the last part of the book, which focuses on the future of leadership. So how do you see that future?
Well, one of the chapters in the book is called the Universal Movement. And this phrase, the Universal Movement, is essentially about how complexity emerges out of simplicity, and where we see detail unfolding in sort of nested degrees of ever more complex structures and functions. And it's the basis by which all life comes into existence in the universe. So this is a big, broad concept. In nature, we see, you know, thinking with my biological hat on, the process of evolution, for example, the emergence of forms that are increasingly complex, you know, independent, autonomous. So one end of the scale, we might see sort of cellular organisms, eukaryotic cells emerging into tissues, to becoming organs, to plants, to becoming animals, to becoming families, communities, ecosystems, ultimately living planets. So life shows this sort of increasing complexity at every scale. Another way we can talk about the universal movement is about the experience of change. We all experience that. This sort of asymmetrical aspect of our experience is undeniable. And so from the perspective of humanity, we can also see the universal movement as the evolution of human experience. And we can say that that is also rising through a series of waves or periods in human history that mark this sort of inexorable progression towards complexity and autonomy and balance. And as humanity, through, you know, its organizations and systems and technologies, seem to evolve, we can see that ego and the role that ego plays as an integral aspect of human experience and perspective also evolves. And so that's what I talk about. And I describe it through different waves, almost like chapters in the story of humanity, of how human experience has evolved. And in the same way, we can talk about how leadership will therefore evolve. So what does that look like? So the first wave is when ego came into existence. This is the age of self. It's the emergence of pre-civilization. It predates the onset of formal societies and rule-based systems of social organization. It's what we talk about when we talk about the dawn of modern man. And different dates are used to describe, you know, this turning point in human history and creativity. Some put it around 60,000 years ago. And it's where we see the first emergence of sort of artifacts of abstract thought, where we see evidence of ceremony and self-conscious awareness. It's where we see those first cave paintings, you know, the first stories begin to appear, that evidence of that. That's the first wave. The wave we're in is what I would call the second wave. And this is the age of the centrally controlled system. And this period started probably some 6,000 years ago. We could look, for example, to the city of Sumer in Mesopotamia, today's southern Iraq, is perhaps the first known complex civilization. And this second wave is where we see ego evolving to reflect kind of a broader collective identification between the self and the organization, you know, the role that I play. And one of the symptoms of this second wave sort of is the unsustainable responses, is this challenge of growth, the unsustainable of growth. So while not all ego organizations grow, you know, it could be due to the imposition of, you know, regulatory or other controls, it's the inclination of ego organizations to seek growth, to become more than they are. It's the nature of ego. We've lost 70% of our wildlife populations in the last 50 years alone. It's incredible. And the devastation that's wrought on our ecosystems as we, you know, continue to plunder its resources is testament to this, as we, you know, we seek that fulfillment through materialistic experience. It's a core feature of the second wave. And so one of the things that's true about the second wave is that it's heading towards what we could call an eco-death. We all see this, this, you know, escalating destruction, not just in terms of sort of ecological systems, but also economic systems. They're equally struggling to stand up, given their sort of linear models, the obsession with profitability. They're proving unsustainable. In what I'd call a capitalist non-linear economy, one of the challenges is value is locked away through ownership. It's one of the features, you know, through the ownership of natural resources, for example, or the interest on loans. So consider, for example, the intrinsic value lost to a financial system for every £10 invested in shares rather than perhaps funding the education of a child who can't afford to learn. And because the value that's locked away doesn't need to be earned for the value to increase, the system is rigged. And the rich cannot get richer without the poor getting poorer. That's a trap. So this inequity arises from the egoic need and assertion of this ownership, the belief that value should be owned and controlled rather than shared equitably, you know, and distributed solely to the flow of goods and services. So I do think today, when we look at the second wave, organizations and societies of every size and shape and color have a simple and profound choice. It's a choice that becomes ever more apparent to leaders as they themselves, you know, move up the ranks of an organization. So either in resistance, they seek ever greater control, and that satisfies ego, or in acceptance, they relinquish it through the empowerment of others. And it's the latter that will take us to the third wave. So the third wave, this sort of third period, is what I would call our closest future. And it's where we will transcend the limitations of centralized systems of control, you know, whether it's capitalist or communist in nature, towards a far more non-hierarchical, interdependent system of mutual empowerment. And one of the ways that we can talk about that next way, the next period, is to consider the metaverse, the role the metaverse plays. So it really represents a fundamental paradigm shift from the conventions of centralized control today towards a radically decentralized system. What I say is from ecosystems to ecosystems. It's in which new kind of form of organization will have to thrive through a symbiosis with its environment. It's radically different from today. But we shouldn't think of the metaverse really just in terms of technology, because that is how we kind of come at it today. You know, Web 3.0, virtual reality, it's not really about that. Really, it's about the change in human experience, because more important than what the metaverse is why it is. And its purpose, as conceived, is for the fulfillment of ego. So knowingly or not, it's the ultimate control of experience. You know, its inception in that sense is inevitable. It's the ultimate ego trip, because we'll seek, as with all experience, to lose ourselves within it. And in that sense, it is almost our ultimate act of futility. Ultimately, the eco death of the second wave will give way to this sort of collective ego death in the third wave. So ultimately, that's where I think we're heading. It has profound implications for leadership. But ultimately, we're leading towards a much more conscious way of leading through far more decentralized systems when we look closely to the future.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that's the case. But in the book, you also share your leadership manifesto, which contains 8 conscious imperatives. So to conclude our very insightful conversation, James, could you share just 2 or 3 of them with us now?
Yeah, the leadership manifesto, the idea behind that was to provide a universal framework for leaders everywhere to lead this transition I describe from sort of the sustainable, or I should say unsustainable, the ecosystems of today to the sustainable ecosystems of the future. How do we lead that transition? So it's designed to really invite a profound shift in really the modern day perspective of the role that leadership plays. And so these 8 conscious imperatives are kind of calls to action, really designed to embolden leaders to play a different role, you know, as disruptors and provocateurs to lead this transition. And part of the power of these 8 imperatives and why it's a universal framework is that they, again, directly address these 8 core tenets of ego that underpinning egoic beliefs through much of the dysfunction is currently, you know, sustained. And these sort of 8 calls to action look at, for example, how can leaders create radical transparency? So how can we create radical transparency to create radical ownership? Radical empowerment through radical ownership. Another example is how can we think about how we bring in the people that we need to the challenges, the huge challenges that we have today in a different way. So I talk about how we need to crowdsource our talent to really access a global talent marketplace in a way that we haven't perhaps thought of today. You know, we limit that to thinking about tightly defined roles. We need to think about crowdsourcing around our most important experiences that work can provide. Also, we talk about in the manifesto How can we think about step changing performance by creating organizations that aren't just more flexible, but actually are more fragile? Interesting idea, but how organizations need to be more fragile. So I introduced a concept called fully realized agile. How do organizations need to get an exquisite balance to really think about how they can serve customers best? The manifesto also talks about how we need to rethink thinking, and particularly how we need to use deep thinking to lean into some of our most impenetrable problems. So rethinking thinking can have a profound effect. And I also talk about within the manifesto about rules and how we need to abandon many of the rules that hold us back so that we can build more permissionless, what I would say, trustless system. That's how we're going to create some of the change that's necessary when we look at a more decentralized world. We're going to have to abandon many of the rules that hold us back. And I also talk about organizational learning. And one of the ways that we can accelerate organizational learning, and that the manifesto talks about, is through a very specific type of feedback. Feedback can have huge power. So I talk about something called fast feedback and the role that that can play. So I'll talk about one of these examples, just to kind of bring it to life. And if I talk about this example around creating radical transparency, which is going to be a fundamental role that leaders will have to play in the future. And it's one that many leaders recognize today. It's about how can we create more access to information, to feedback, to learning, to all of it. Organizations spend an enormous amount of time and money to control access to information, the flow of information to people, to help them get what they need. But every time we limit access to information, we risk creating mistrust and inequity because access gets afforded according to certain privileges, such as managerial rank, for example. And so if we want employees to really care about an organization, we're really asking them to act as if they own it. And so we need to provide the same level of trust as if they were the owners and they own the information within it. So, for example, this means that we need to think about learning, think about how we might de-restrict learning, encourage learning in all its forms. You know, one of the misunderstandings is that there's something called self-led learning and there's something that isn't self-led learning. All learning is only ever self-led. So how do we kind of embrace that? At the same time, and again, paradoxically, leaders need to limit what they know. There's so much information out there. So to be effective, leaders need to know less. You know, they need to be ruthless in determining what will enable them to take meaningful action and what will hold them back. And leaders often hold on to this sort of information security blanket. They know more than they need to know, or they know what's not relevant. So how can they know less but make it more meaningful? And this conscious imperative, what underpins it essentially is this, the one of the egoic tenets is around this belief in the world that's separate to me. And it's through our sense of separateness, we instinctively look to hold on to what we have and what we know for personal gain. So through ego, we operate in silos, we control access to knowledge, to experiences, in the belief that we gain power through their transaction. But through conscious leadership, you know, as we create conscious connections to others, we close that gap. And so we allow, when we go open access, we allow value to flow more freely. So really, I mean, my hope with the manifesto is, and actually what Ego Flip overall provides, I'm hoping it provides really new paradigm for how to lead in the future, but also a radical, but also really practical vision for leaders to understand what it means to lead beyond the ego.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, James, for your time speaking with me today. It's very interesting and insightful. And of course, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of your book to read more. But thanks once again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcasts.